Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to the Extra Sauce Podcast.
It's my fancy sauce.
I want some fancy sauce.
Yeah.
I'm not done using it.
With the czar of sauces, Greg Hill.
This is it, Volume 1, Episode 1 of Extra Sauce, my weekly podcast, which will follow up on the Hillman Morning Show content that we felt may need a little extra sauce. And never let it be said, Shu, that even on my deathbed, I am not here for you and for the listeners.
And at least we'll know why that I end up in the emergency room hacking my lungs out.
Yes, you drew the short straw on that.
That's right. This week.
Now, I do want to point out, when I say weekly, that does not take into consideration my 5 weeks of vacation, sick days, federal holidays, and personal days.
Right.
Okay. And Shu is here as the co-host this week, and on a rotating basis, I will be joined by some of the greatest talents in the industry. Like Danielle and Lyndon Byers.
I was wondering who that was.
Yeah, I'm sure. So was I, yes. On this first episode of Extra Sauce, we will get extra sauce from Ken Kratz, the prosecutor in the Stephen Avery case. We'll also get it from the dude you bang in that boat woman from Brighton. And we'll get extra sauce on Sting's Oscar-winning performance on the Oscars this past Sunday. But first up were those of us who watched Making a Murderer on Netflix and believed Stephen Avery was innocent, duped by the filmmakers who used deceptive techniques in creating that documentary. It's a question we asked on the show this past week after interviewing the prosecutor in the case, Ken Kratz. And it's one that we thought needed a little extra sauce. So Ken joins us right now to delve a little deeper into it.
Thanks very much, guys, for having me. Appreciate it.
One of the things that happened when we had you on last week was that listeners were demanding more. And so that's why we're getting the extra sauce with you today. And I think that towards the end of our discussion, you really started to let yourself express the frustration that you have with the documentary filmmakers and the way that you were portrayed in Making a Murderer.
You know, the larger discussion, there's a lot of larger discussions, but one of the larger discussions, I believe, has to do with the documentary filmmaking industry itself. They're the only ones that are going to be able to set some standards for editing practices. And as I mentioned last week, you're not just going to not criticize or not provide any consequences, but you're going to give them the Emmy. You're going to make them the gold standard for documentary film editing. You're going to get exactly that. If this is going to be the tip of the spear, can you imagine how far they're going to push the envelope until the consumer is going to rise up and say, this isn't what we thought documentary filmmaking was all about. We always felt it was had a little bit of a different twist to it, and that's what makes it so compelling. That's what makes it so riveting, is that you're watching something that actually happened.
What would you say are the most egregious violations of documentary standards when it comes to Making a Murderer?
Yeah. Well, you can do that in a number of ways. You can talk about editing practices or deceptive editing practices, like, omissions. Now, omissions are going to happen. That's simply just not including everything, and that's the easy one, where these filmmakers have been able to get away with saying because of time constraints, they couldn't put it all in there, right? So, you know, anytime you would mention there's no hoodlatch DNA or the fact that the bullet matched the Stephen Avery's rifle or his efforts to lure her on the property or all of her electronics are found in the burn barrel or, you know, on and on and on and on, the filmmakers can fall back and say, look, we couldn't include it all. And that's a hard thing to get into that discussion with, because you kind of got to give them that. You know what I mean? You're not going to be able to put everything in there. And all you can do then is complain about editorial decision making and say, well, you know, some of these were central parts of the prosecution case, the prosecution theme.
Yeah.
You know, why wouldn't you include those? And of course, you're going to be chasing your tail. Cherry picking is simply presenting evidence that supports only your conclusion, and of course, leaving out all the stuff that doesn't. But then you get into the bigger stuff. You get into actually cutting, that is, removing key words or phrases from a statement. Or a good example in Making Murderer is a voicemail call that Teresa Halbach makes to the Avery property, in which she says, you know, I'm coming there right now. And the Making a Murderer is the very beginning, in fact, the very opening sequence of episode number 2 of the piece. It has Teresa saying, you know, I'll be there, you know, maybe between 2 and 2:30 or something like that. What they cut out, though, the 5 or 6 seconds out of the middle, the only part that they cut out of the middle of this call, is where Teresa says, I don't know where I'm going, and I'm going to need a call back from you so that you can give me the address. Now, why is that important? Well, it's important because the state's theory was that Teresa was lured to that property because of some nonsense that happened 3 weeks earlier, back on October 10th. And so to ignore or to hide the fact of this luring, they simply leave it out. That's egregious. That's something that shouldn't be done.
As a lawyer, and as like a regular lawyer and a DA, have you ever done that, presenting a case, maybe omitted some things to make your message more convincing?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know that I have ever purposefully done that. Although here's the difference, you know, in an advocacy role, there's another lawyer sitting 4 feet away from me who is going to jump up and say, ladies and gentlemen, the jury, here's what Mr. Kress didn't tell you. He hid this from you. Well, you know, I don't get to sit in everybody's living room and say, wait a second, what about those 5 seconds that they just cut out of here? Let's set all of that stuff aside, guys, because the one thing that eclipses all of this other stuff is the practice called slicing. That's the willingness to take an answer given in one area and attaching that to a question from a different area. And when Making a Murderer demonstrates their willingness to do that, Andy Colburn is being cross-examined by Dean Strang, and he's asked these questions about the license plate and the dramatic, you know, cue the dramatic music, and he says, you know, well, wouldn't you agree with us, Sergeant Colburn, that you know, makes you look suspicious, that from the outside that it looks suspicious? And Andy, you know, sheepishly is shown answering yes. Well, when, and that goes, you know, that's the last, I think the very last thing before the cliffhanger, you know, before the next episode. Well, when you realize that Andy never answers that question, when that yes answer is harvested from a different question and put in there, somebody's got to ask these filmmakers, why would you do that?
Ken, do you believe the filmmakers omitted facts and may have used deceptive editing techniques because they felt Stephen Avery was innocent, or because it made Making a Murderer better television?
You know, I thought about that very question for a long time, and I honestly believe it was the former. Because if it was just about entertainment, if it's just about, you know, what is a better story, or what, you know, what's a more compelling way to advance our narrative here, you can still do that by showing both sides of this case. It's still a terrific documentary if you show both sides. But you have to go that extra mile in order to make them look innocent.
What do you think Netflix should do about season two of Making a Murderer?
Well, I don't know. I think Netflix is doing well. Look, I don't get to tell Netflix what to do. They've never answered a question, not once, on this issue, and I don't expect them to. I think they're doing just what they should, at least publicly. They're going to sit back and they're going to say, you know, whatever the market is going to bear is what we're going to do, what we're going to allow. I'm not sure Netflix has that obligation to do that. The bigger question, I think, is what did Netflix know beforehand? In other words, what did Netflix know before these filmmakers came to them? And did they ask them, are there these kinds of things in here? Is there, you know, is there splicing? Is there misrepresentation? And especially something this potentially incendiary, you're going to want to make it in the industry what's called bulletproof. You know, you're going to want to make sure that you don't have people screaming and yelling, because there's a defamation type of lawsuit that is called false light. That is when you intentionally portray somebody in a false light. You can be sued, you know, a lot for that.
Ken, thanks for joining us again on Extra Sauce.
You guys have been fantastic, and I've really appreciated our talk. Thanks very much.
As is well documented, there are a lot of inside jokes on the show and a lot of drops that we play where newer listeners are asking, what is that from? Who is that? Why is that person saying that? So one of the things that we're going to do every week on this podcast is get a little extra sauce and return to some radio gold moments that have occurred on this show.
And there's so many.
Really?
Yeah.
Are there? Are
so
you sure?
Very many.
All right. So we're going to go back to an Opinions Under the Influence segment, which is often referenced on the Hillman Morning Show, and listen to Ella from Brighton, who was overserved and interviewed by our former producer.
Does she really need extra sauce?
No, extra sauce. Yeah, this is called extra sauce.
That's right.
Yes.
So we got to do this?
Hello. This is Ella. Figuring it out. I've lived in this country for 9.5 years. I only ever came here for... I came here really to save enough money, because, you know, America is the land of the money. And guess what? I fell in love with America. But I went to Fenway, and I've been in the Heineken box. Jesus. Which means you drink all of the Heineken products. It means... Heineken. Excuse me. I'm in the back of the place you left me. Anyway, I'm at the back, but I'm literally being interviewed by WAAF. I'm in the back. Liam, being interviewed by WAAF. They're so excited when I say their name. Give me the address. I'm downstairs, you f***ing donkey.
All right, this first one is scientists believe we can translate what our pets say.
Oh, okay. So here's it.
Scientists in the future will be able to translate our pets' sounds and turn them into English using artificial intelligence.
I would like this to be the top comment, because yes, that is the top comment, because oh my God, are you serious? Are you for real?
Yes, of course it is. That is disgusting. That. Can I just ask you for 1 second to repeat the comment that you just said?
Oh my God.
I hear cats. That's a thought. Listen, I see his cat, I see his dog, but I am me, and I am someone who doesn't. I'm sorry, I don't care. Oh no. Stop milking me. You know what? You got me in a bad corner. I would say I'm partially drunk, but it's tough when you're kind of, you know?
In Florida, a teenager suffered a bite to the head after he kicked a log. That log turned out to be an alligator.
There's an alligator involved? It's so bad. But honestly, if an alligator was attacking me, I'd give him one look, check him out, see, then I'd get him, I'd take him, and I would put his face in my face, and I'd slap him left, right, and guess what? I'd take him into the dance party where everything else is happening. Oh my God, I can't believe it. It's an alligator. It's gonna chalk off your head. Chomp, chomp.
An Ohio man was arrested for having sex with a pool raft in an alley for the second time.
Can I get that repeated to me once more? You said a pool raft, right? Like an inflatable pool raft. And he put his penis against it?
Yes.
So you want my comments? Oh. Is that what I say in America? OMG? Let me. Should I put my against my... I would say, dude, you banging that boat? And he would say, yes, I'm banging that boat. People that want sex on boats. Why the fuck? I like, really and truly. Listen to me. Listen now. Be a pro, be a... Listen, people are having sex with boats. Is that what you're saying to me? See, now it's a whole new... Look at you. I love WAF. You're such sketchy c***. Boop. Beep, 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 beep. You're not sketchy. Beep, beep, f***ers. I like, can't even talk to you anymore because... Why would I? Next question.
Ella from Ireland. That's Ella from Ireland.
Take you out and bang some boats.
On opinions under the influence today.
Dude, you banging that boat?
When it comes to opening our borders up, if it's a whole bunch of Ellas that are coming across, I have absolutely no problem with that, Joe.
I don't think she'd be able to make it over any wall.
Yeah, you're probably right about that. Finally this week, during our discussion on the morning after the Oscars, we talked about Sting's performance of The Empty Chair and decided to get some extra sauce on the documentary that Oscar-nominated song comes from. It's called Jim, and it's about conflict journalist Jim Foley, who was beheaded by ISIS in 2014. The director of the documentary is Brian Oakes, and he joins us now for some extra sauce.
Thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure.
I was immediately struck by the film you made because Jim, being your childhood friend, almost seemed like as he grew up, he took him a while, but he found his way, and I think you did a great job in this documentary of kind of telling that part of his life story.
Yeah, you know, Jim was, he got into journalism kind of late in life, as far as I think journalists go. I think he was about, you know, I think he was about 36 when he went on his first assignment to the Middle East, when he was embedded with the Indiana National Guard. And yeah, his journey was, it was kind of, you know, I think very relatable to a lot of people like us who, you know, kind of take maybe a little bit longer to kind of figure out what we want to do. I mean, he was always really interested in writing, and he was writing a novel early in his career and writing a lot of fiction. And I think, but his fiction was kind of based on his life experiences of being a teacher at Teach for America and working in the Chicago prison systems. And I think, you know, what ultimately happened, he's like, you know, why am I kind of spinning my wheels writing fiction based on kind of real life experiences anyway, when I could be actually doing the real thing? And I think ultimately that's what led him to journalism school and ultimately loving, you know, doing journalism.
Jim was kidnapped in Benghazi in 2011 and obviously got out, came back, and then, and by the way, his family, I think the documentary shows most of them asked the same question that I'm going to ask, which is why? Why did he go back?
Yeah, well, it's a great question, and it's the question I had, and it's ultimately, I believe, the theme of the film, and I think it's a topic that not only is related to Jim, but I think for, you know, you could, as kind of a metaphor for other journalists who are in conflict journalists, even soldiers to a degree, and people who you know, even, you know, people who risk their lives in their careers. You know, these conflict journalists, they go into these war-torn areas and they see a reality that none of us really are accustomed to, kind of here in our, you know, quote, safety of you know, our country. And when they leave that environment and come back to, you know, to the real world, it's a really difficult adjustment. There's a lot of post-traumatic stress that I think you know, Jim was suffering from, and that is, you know, it draws them back. It's kind of like they have this almost like you know, guilt that kind of wants to bring them back into those conflict zones and cover these stories and tell the stories of these people. In Jim's case, you know, the Libyan rebels and the Syrian civilians who are kind of suffering in these war-torn areas. And I think there is that kind of, you know, draw that brings them back. Another layer to that question is, you know, these journalists feel like they're documenting history, and that's very important. You know, I refer to some parts in the film, you know, there's images of World War II and images of Vietnam, and these are really important moments in the history of our world and of our civilization, that if we don't document this, we can't learn and we can't move forward. And I think a lot of what these journalists feel is that they have a duty and a responsibility to document this.
You point out in the film that the video of Jim's beheading is the second most watched moment behind September 11th when it comes to video. And you chose not to show that beheading video in Jim. Why?
Well, I mean, the statistic of the second most, that was, we sourced that from the Wall Street Journal, who did that survey. So that's where that came from. As far as the decision for the video, you know, this film ultimately was not about Jim's death. It was about his life. I consider that video, it's a propaganda piece. It's war pornography. It is a recruitment video by ISIS to, you know, to try to popularize their activity and potentially, you know, recruit people who might be attracted to that kind of imagery. And so that's just not in the point of view of the film. It's not something that I've even watched myself. And I think more importantly, it's not something that I'm going to put in a film, because a lot of people, I don't think, would want to see that, and that's not a choice that I would want to take away from someone.
One of the one of the interesting things in the film from a theme perspective is, you know, not only Jim's family, but his friends and others kind of wondering why the United States of America didn't do what other countries did and pay a ransom for the release of Jim. And I wonder, now that the film's out and you've had time to think about that as it relates to, you know, one of your best friends, a guy you grew up with, do you have second thoughts about our policy when it comes to paying ransom?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of, you know, I kind of, you know, as a documentary filmmaker and as a trying to be as objective as possible, I never really wanted to form a strong opinion during the making of the film, because, you know, you want to, just like Jimmy would in his journalism, you always want to hear the other side of the story. Like, you're always trying to put yourself in other people's shoes and understand their perspective. And just like hostage policy, I can see both sides of the coin. Like, I understand a policy that says we will not negotiate, we're terrorists, we will not give them money, we will not pay ransom, because ultimately what we're doing is we are funding terrorists, and they may use that money to, you know, go commit a terrorist act in a country or on people. I understand that perspective. I also understand the perspective of the other side, which is you should do anything as a country and as a government to get your citizens out of a hostage situation with any means possible.
As the film ends, and I was bawling my eyes out listening to the letter that Jim had wanted to be sent home to his family. You end it with the empty chair, the Sting song, and I think it was perfect. And I'm wondering how that came about.
Yeah, so that came about. It was pretty incredible. Josh Ralph, who did music and lyrics with Sting on that. Jay was our original composer of the film. Ultimately didn't compose the score. Dan Romer was ultimately made the beautiful score for the film. He's amazing. Jay ended up finding a song. Let me do a song for the film. And he reached out to Sting, who watched the film, and at first was like, I can't do this. This is just way too hard. It's too much for me to take on. And the story goes that Sting then showed his wife, Trudy, who said, you have to do this. And he was like, well, let me think about that. And so he did. And he ultimately sat down, in a very quick time. He said it was over Thanksgiving, and he kind of thought about what it would be like if he had a family member missing, and kind of looked around the Thanksgiving table with an empty chair, and that's how he was kind of inspired by it. And him and Jay kind of came together and wrote it. It was incredible, he was really. Sting's been great. I mean, he came to Sundance Film Festival and performed the song back in 2016 when we premiered it at Sundance, and has just been so gracious with his time and his efforts and his compassion with the film, and has been to multiple screenings, and I couldn't thank those guys enough, because it's really added a really nice element to the film. I mean, with this film, it was a little tricky at the beginning, because you adding that celebrity aspect to it was like, eesh, are we kind of walking a weird line here? But ultimately Sting understood that and said, I'm going to very simple and kind of took us out. And ultimately I think it was great, because he brought, of course, with the Oscar performance, he's just brought more awareness to Jim and his story and ultimately journalism and what that especially now with what we're going through with the political climate of journalism and the administration, I think it's a, even now it's a relevant story, and any attention that you know we can get on Jimmy and journalism, I think is a good for the country.
Brian, this is my last question. We've all lost somebody, and I think felt like we missed an opportunity to say something to them, or we missed an opportunity to tell them what they meant to us. Is this film a way that you can that you could do that for Jim? And did you feel like there were things that you learned about Jim in the making of this movie that you wish you could have been able to say to him?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, you always have kind of regrets or something that you're, you know, when you lose someone and you're like, oh, I never got a chance to tell him this, or, you know, my last text with Jim was right before, it was like Thanksgiving before the last time he went into Syria, and he was like, hey, I'm coming through New York. I got to pick up a helmet before I go back, and let me come through Brooklyn and see you. I got to do this, or I couldn't remember even what I did, and I didn't get a chance to see him. And that, you know, to this day, it's like, oh, you know, if I could have just seen him that last time.
Well, Brian, thank you for making the film, and thank you for joining us on Extra Sauce.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, you guys.
All right. That's a wrap on episode one of Extra Sauce. I'm going to go gargle with salt water or enjoy some tea and lemon and work on getting my voice back.
Well, how about what that guy suggested this week? Taking a spoonful of Vicks mixed with sugar?
Not happening.
Okay.
That is not happening.
Your eyeballs will explode.
Yeah. If there's something you would like to hear on Extra Sauce, tweet me, Greg Hill, WAAF. And we'll be back next week with episode number two. Thanks for listening.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.